So I want to tell you just in 10 minutes what a super salad is, what it's defined as, maybe connecting with some other ideas you've had. And Moses has put up this phase diagram, which maybe can review the situation, the conventional picture of helium. So all of this, most of this phase diagram was discovered like in 1920 or so, going back. So helium, of course, is unique in that it's the only element that is liquid all the way down to T equals zero. We're going to talk about helium-4, which is a boson, and like they're just like little small hard spheres with a very weak attraction. And so this is the famous lambda line where you go from a normal liquid to a superfluid. But if you do compress helium, it goes into a solid. Okay, and the super solid is in here. Why do we know that? What do we mean by it's very quantum solid? And so that's the first concept, is what is a crystal? And the definition, the operative definition, is it's something that gives Bragg scattering, right? That the density in the crystal, you know, is a periodic density, just like even if it's a quantum crystal, it's like a classical, the density is still periodic, and so that's something you can see experimentally, right? You can do X-ray scattering or neutron scattering, and you can see that it's an HCP crystal, and that's a tiny little BCC phase there. And it also has other phases, but not important. But the experiments are going to be up in here at higher pressures that Moses will talk about. Okay, so that's the solid part. And the super part is superfluid. What do we mean by a superfluid? Well, there's several concepts here. First of all, there's the Landau definition, which is, in fact, what's used in Moses' experiment. That is, if you take a superfluid, this is the famous Andrina-Cacciavalli experiment, and you rotate it very slowly, any normal liquid will get entrained by the walls and will rotate like a rigid body if you do it slowly enough. However, if you had a cup of helium here, and if you cooled it down through the lambda transition, right at the lambda transition, it stops rotating as you go through there, and it can decouple from the walls. And you could say simply that it has, since it doesn't have viscosity, it opens up a gap to excitations, it can do this, and it has a lower energy state by not rotating. So it goes into that. So that's what's called, in the jargon, NCRI, or non-classical rotational inertia, and that's what's actually measured. Essentially doing that experiment of rotating a sample and seeing what rotates and what doesn't rotate. So then there were in the 50s, a later definition was Bose condensation. This was Onziger and Penrose. The idea is that there's a phase coherence through the sample. In fact, it was Fritz London's concept that actually helium is the type of Bose condensation, but it occurs in highly correlated systems as well as in, you know, these atomic vapors. It's essentially the same phenomena. And so there you have condensation into a single mode, in K equals zero mode, in the case of helium. That was the situation through the 50s and 60s, but then people began wondering, well, what could you have some unusual properties in the solid phase? And there were three papers in 1969 and 1970 which gave rise to the concept of a supersolid. The first one was by Andreev and Lifshitz in 69. I think these three papers were sort of independent of each other, but they all occurred within a year or so. Andreev and Lifshitz actually proposed a specific mechanism for Bose condensation in the crystal, and this is the simplest one to understand that I'll explain. Basically, if you have a crystal, you know that you have vacancies, right? And if you take iron or any type of crystal, that is a thermal excitation to have vacancies. It's an excited state. And Andreev and Lifshitz hypothesized that you could have vacancies at very low temperature. I mean, the idea is that These are like, the solid is like the vacuum, and these are like vacuum fluctuations, right? You have, I mean, in fact, if you look at solid helium, the fluctuations are on the particles are moving sort of half the lattice distance just with zero point motion, and so you quite commonly see vacancy fluctuations. And if you have a certain fraction of vacancies at zero temperature, then inevitably they have to Bose condense because the vacancies are bosons, and they would have to Bose condense. And these, you would think of these as just like an ideal gas of bosons. But of course, it depends on how many of them there would be, and how they depend on temperature. And so they couldn't really answer that question. But that's the Andreev mechanism, that there are vacancies and they Bose condense. About the same time, Geoffrey Chester proved that if you take a simple wave function for helium, this must have Bose condensation. It's actually kind of a nice mapping onto a classical system. You know that any classical crystal will have some thermally activated vacancies. I mean, there is a certain probability for getting a vacancy, and you have to calculate the energy and so forth. But a crystal like neon, for example, this is a classical crystal, is described by a pair interaction. And you can, the most common wave function for liquid helium is a pair wave function. It's called a Jastrow wave function. It's Bill McMillan showed that it was a very good wave function for helium. So there's this analogy between a pair wave function and a pair potential, the classical system. I mean, it's a mapping. So if you can find a system that's well described by Jastrow wave function that crystallizes, because the classical system must have vacancies, the quantum system must Bose condense. But there's an if there, as a condition, because you don't know if that wave function, which is good in the liquid phase, will be good in the solid phase. You could actually ask for the potential that would do that, but it doesn't look anything like the helium potential. And then the same year, Tony Leggett also said that you should get this NCRI, you could get the NCRI property, that is the non-classical rotational property, with a quantum crystal. That is, his picture is more that the quantum crystal is like, well, just like a charged density wave, that you have some sort of periodic density, and maybe you can have a quantum fluid that has that sort of periodic density. And, you know, he speculated that that might happen. He didn't say what the mechanism was, but just basically, you have this quantum system, and yeah, it has like a density wave in it, but that doesn't forbid it also from flowing. Okay. Almost everything is what?
If the density, if you think the density is almost uniform with solar migration, then both of the substances are interstitials.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. If you look in Phil Anderson's book from the 70s, Basic Notion of Condensed Matter Physics, he actually goes into this question in some detail. And, you know, I think he points out rightly, well, this is a question whether quantum solid helium is like an insulator where you have no vacancy, or if you have vacancy fluctuations, but they're stuck, they're localized. Or is it like a metal where the atoms are sort of free to move? And so there could really be a phase transition. And then there were a number of experiments from the 70s up until 2000 something, which didn't really find anything in the supersolid. And I think maybe I could stop there and Moses can take over. Yeah.
So I beg your pardon that it's not very easy for me to do a blackboard talk. And so this is the thing that David was talking about, this RMS motion, if you do X-ray scattering, you can measure what is RMS motion of the helium sitting in the lattice. What is amazing is that it's very large. That means there's a lot of motion there going on. And perhaps some of you remember your solid state physics course. Typically for ordinary solid, that if this number gets to about 10% or 15%, it should melt. But for solid helium, it is rather unusual. Now, and here, this is X-ray. We didn't really plan that very much, but it works extremely well. David said those are the experiments that have been done. Over the years, there are quite a lot of experiments done to look for the supersolid phase. And you notice that most people give up, except one person, John Goodkind, who is sitting in the back there. John Goodkind, for the last 15 years, have been looking for supersolid. And he had been doing ultrasound measurement, and I should give him credit. That is one of his experiments. He may remember one of the conversations we have in 1999. Then he saw something rather unusual in the ultrasonic signal, namely the fact that there seems to be a region where pure solid helium, but very small amount of helium-3. Then he sees dissipation, the ultrasound signal, and also the velocity increases. That has spiked our interest. I don't have time to go through all that, so in fact I will just go through one set of experiment that we have done. I will make comments to others. The technique that of the data I was showing you is actually freshman physics. It's torsional pendulum. The torsional pendulum, just imagine that if you had taught the freshman physics course, you fix it at one end and you torque it at the bottom, and you said that in this particular case it's a simple harmonic motion. Therefore the period, there's a resonant period. The resonant period depends on both the moment of inertia and the spring constant of this torsion rod. Okay? In the experiment that this technique of looking for superfluidity, as David pointed out, is follow the idea of Andralikashvili of the Kapitsis school. And it'd be modified by John Reppe, my mentor at Cornell, that instead of using a very, very flimsy fiber, John Reppe and a lot of his students, actually after I left Cornell, used a technique as actually a beryllium copper as alloy. And the wonderful thing about doing things at low temperature is that in that particular case, the dislocation in this alloy are completely frozen in. The consequence of that is the mechanical Q can be very high. Mechanical Q means the following. It means, for example, that if you have a fancy wine glasses, you hit it, it rings for a long time. You can show off to your dinner guests that how much a person you value the nice things of life. Or if you are boring electrical engineer, you say, oh, the mechanical Q is simply that if you drive it at a particular resonant frequency, and it's the width of the frequency dividing that is mechanical Q. Okay. So what happened is that, as it turned out, it's relatively easy to build an electrical circuit for you to lock in on this particular frequency. Therefore, in this particular way, therefore, if something is happening to the resonant mode due to this getting smaller, then you will notice that there will be a shift. There will be a shift in the period or the frequency. Okay, so that is a simple idea. All right. And in fact, John Reppe and his student David Bishop and his postdoc Burko developed the technique, and they first used it about in the late 1970s. And they did an experiment is actually measuring the superfluid. At that time, was interested in knowing whether helium film can be a superfluid. So this is not bulk liquid, but a film of helium. So they use it to absorb helium into pores of what we call a porous media called vicor glass. This is the white space, the empty space in here, is 28%. But the interesting thing is that they're all connected. You can go from one place to another. It's sort of a sponge. Okay. So then what you do is that you, this is about 70 angstrom, you absorb a couple layers that helium absorb onto glass because there are more electrons in the glass than helium. Therefore, what the van der Waal force, helium would be like to absorb onto the glass. That's the same reason that on your hand, there are many layers of water on your hand, there's absorption on that. And the first couple layers, we know that there's a so-called amorphous layer. It's sort of solid-like because of the large van der Waals or Lennard-Jones potential. But beyond a couple layers, then actually form a liquid. Now, the liquid has a viscous penetration depth. If you oscillate it, that would be the same reason that you have a Coke in your hand. If you oscillate it, you know that the liquid close to the wall will not move at all because of the viscous penetration depth. A normal liquid, if it's less than an atomic layer, will not move. But what they find out is that if they cool it down, this is a helium in microglass couple layers, and then when they go to a particular low transition, depends on the coverage of the helium, then they see a drop in the resonant period. What he's shown here, this is a resonant period, subtract amount because we want to emphasize what's going on. My laser pointer is dying. There is another one here, right? Let me, here. Which way? Okay. All right, this is dying too, or something.
Did you track those numbers?
Oh, okay, thanks. So you see a deficit, and the deficit is interpreted by saying the fact, like David said, in the superfluid state, it is actually that it has no viscosity, or it is a zero momentum state. When this little disk with the vicor glass in here, when this is, the matrix is moving back and forth, helium is sitting there impervious, it's stationary. It's stationary, therefore it does not participate in the oscillatory motion, therefore it is a deficit in the resonant period. Is it okay? Right? So what happened that if you flip this upside down, and this gives you basically, now this is due to if you increase the helium coverage, then you have the situation that the transition temperature go higher and higher, and this sort of phenomena can be understood. Maybe some of you have heard the so-called the Korsler-Thouless transition for superfluid transition in the helium film. Okay? So this is basically a technique. We have done a number of experiments. Let me just show you perhaps an experiment that perhaps is the easiest for me to talk about in the next 5 minutes. We use a torsion oscillator technique, and in particular, we make it such that this is a torsion bob in here, and we confine the solid helium in the annulus. It's just like a racetrack, going around in a racetrack, okay? So the solid helium in here is this light blue, and inside here the helium is brought into this annulus space from the liquid, and then you pressurize it and so on and so forth. All right? Okay? So it's a very small scale physics. I understand you guys do some of the very big scale physics. This is very small scale physics, 3.5 centimeter, that's all. Okay. Very cheap, too. So basically, this is the result. What we have done is, we have shown here is that this is a so-called background. In other words, there are thermal expansion in the very thing. There's always small temperature background. This is measured in nanoseconds. In other words, in this particular oscillator, the frequency is about 1 kilohertz. Therefore, the resonant period is about 1 millisecond. And now we're saying what we see here is that when we cool it down, so this is empty cell background with no helium in there, and then we put helium in it, of course, the total period increase, and then we just change to raise the empty background to match that, to subtract the background. And what we notice that those numbers, 4 microseconds, 6 microseconds, 14 microseconds, what are they? Those are because it's a simple harmonic motion, that is a maximum speed in the middle of the swing of the torsional mode, okay? At the two end, of course, is zero. And four micron per second correspond to what? Correspond that to this oscillation, this thing here. Of course, this much is a picture. This is just drawn on. Okay, we cannot do that. So you know, by the way we drive it again is all freshman physics. It's all freshman physics. You use Coulomb law because this is offset. You use Coulomb law. Put a voltage across it. You feel a force to be attracted to it. You let go. Therefore, oscillate back and forth. Okay. So this amplitude of this little cylinder, the amplitude is 7 angstrom. Correspond to 4 micron per second. So of course this is nothing compared to LIGO, I mean the sensitivity, but we're poor, remember.
This is being driven exactly on resonance?
Yes. Yes.
So does that mean you shift the driving frequency in response to the changes in period?
No, we have a constant drive and detect the amplitude. What is interesting is that when we increase the drive for 6 micron per second, that's the maximum speed, the set of data basically collapsed. There's no change. And this drop is 40 nanoseconds. I forgot to tell you here, the total mass loading is 3,000 nanoseconds. What does that mean? You have, when the cell have no helium in it, then you read the particular, resonant period, okay? And then you add helium into it, it increases by 3,000 nanoseconds. All right? So that is the effect, that's the total effect of due to the mass of the helium loading the oscillator. All right? And now here, by the time you go to low temperature, there's a drop of 14 nanoseconds. Therefore, it allows us to say that in this particular case, 14 nanoseconds out of 3,000 nanoseconds do not participate in the oscillatory motion. Okay? All right? Of course, we did a number of tests, as you show. Helium physicists, the first thing you worry about is whether it's a leak. Helium just leaked out. That is much more reasonable explanation. But we do it a couple of times. We cool down, we warm up, we warm up, we cool down. So if that is going on, then that is a pretty strange Maxwell's demon, because this is, after all, at 51 bar. You have to go from vacuum back into 50. That would be even more amazing result, I suppose. What is interesting is that when you drive it harder, the harder you try, the effect is smaller. Okay? One way to understand that is a phenomenon called critical current in superconductor or critical velocity in superfluid. In other words, if you drive it high enough, you create excitation, and then you, therefore, the system is, you know, will behave as if it's no longer superfluid. One other thing that's interesting that I think is a bit detail, when the superfluid density is changing more rapidly, then there is actually a dip in the amplitude. In the amplitude, that means what? A dip in the amplitude, we're driving a constant voltage, but the oscillation is smaller in amplitude. That simply means that there is some dissipation in the system. Yes?
What happens if you cool it, say, at 4, and then increase the drop?
Here. Yeah, that you see this drop. Yeah. But it's not as easy. You have to change the settings or that sort of thing. So most sensibly, I mean, the data is shown here because doing things at low temperature, and also there must be a lot of either experimentalists here, you know about doing experiment in high Q is that you have to wait for 5 time constant. That means a long time, right? Okay, so all this data, every point is about 1 hour, 2 hours to take. Any question? So if we flip this upside down again, here we're saying that this is again the terminology used by Tony Leggett, non-classical rotational inertia fraction. And here we're saying that this is the effect due to the drive. However, the 4 microseconds and 6 microseconds seem to be collapsed to each other. Therefore, we call it the superfluid density or the supersolid density. Okay, so that is not affected by the velocity. And here, this is the log plot, as my mentor, John Rapid, taught me a long time. It's very important for graphology. Now, graphology, from the days when we were graduate students, very difficult. You have to plot in a graph paper. Nowadays, just one stroke. in the whatever origin, then you get graphology. So in the log scale, it looks like it's very big, and then you plot a linear scale, so basically that's a phenomenon.
What?
There's a number of things very strange. You know, here we are trying to understand a lot of the result that it is, in fact, very strange. Why is it very strange? Well, it is a superfluid phenomenon. If it's a superflow phenomenon, therefore, in the language of phase transition, will be in the same universality class. I hope people have heard about that, the so-called XY model. Therefore, in that particular case, they would expect the superfluid density should drop down with infinite slope, with exponents. You have heard of that, right? It doesn't seem to go like that. Or we say, well, this system like a Bose-Einstein condensation, therefore, it's very dilute density. Therefore, you imagine that this should come down linearly, like a good BEC should. Well, it's not. So those are some of the issues we are grappling with in this workshop.
This is all of them, right?
No, this is bulk.
Bulk. What does it?
Well, T cube, 1 over T cube, pretty good. But the reason we did the experiment in this geometry is to test the one thing, you know, superfluidity and superconductivity in the language of condensed metaphysicists are called macroscopic quantum phenomena. The macroscopic quantum phenomena means saying the fact that the whole system can be described by a many-body wave function that describes the entire state. And that will require that you go around the loop, there is a phase coherence, okay? So the reason we have chosen to do the experiment with this angular geometry putting solid helium is because we have this experiment in mind. We want to put a block in there, okay? When we block in there, I'm masculating as a theorist now. You break up the phase coherence. Doesn't sound good? Sounds really good. Anyway, so we did that experiment, and this has happened to be a different cell. If you people are sharp, this is a bit bigger cell. And so here, now let's go back. This is the experiment that I've shown you before. So this is basically, we're saying the fact that from the laboratory frame, if you're oscillating back and forth, the superfluid or the supersolid part remain stationary. Or if you happen to be a little ant sitting on top of this torsional oscillator looking down, if a little ant looking down on it, then what happens is, according to this little ant, as you oscillate this torsional oscillator back and forth, then the superfluid component is oscillating back and forth, right? It's unimpeded oscillating back and forth, therefore you have a decoupling. Now, if you have this configuration, if I put a block in there, right? Okay? If you put a block in there, you don't have the freedom to oscillate back and forth anymore. You run into a brick wall. Sort of like the movie Animal House, when John Belushi, whoever, is with a marching band going to the wall. Did anyone watch? Is that right? Now you theorists are too uptight. My mentor John Reppy and Dave Lee, the two of them were classmates at UConn and later on at Yale. Apparently, they watch it about 75 times. 7 years of college, all down the drain. Anyway, so therefore, if I'm exactly correct, then there should be no decoupling. But in fact, we do see a little bit. So that was a little bit worrisome, but later on we realized there's a very simple explanation for that. Because when we say there's absolutely no decoupling is not correct, because in this case, the inner radius is not the same as the outer radius. Then when you oscillate back and forth, you force the superfluid component executing potential flow of this pattern. This problem had been worked out by Sandy Feder in 1974, and Eric Miller at Cornell, and actually knowing the geometry and calculate, they say you should see approximately 1.7% of what you expected to see. Therefore, this is really right around the ball, right around what we expect to see. But now, of course, as experimentalists, we always are very weary of theorists. You know, we should be, all right? So there's always trust but verify component in there. We believe you guys, but we're going to test it anyway. So what we did is, with the same cell, with this block cell, we put liquid helium in there. Remember, we said in the first transparency, liquid helium is 100% superfluid. Therefore, if there's no block, 100% will be decoupled. However, with this block, what happened? What did we see is, in cell expected 5,000 nanoseconds, we see 93 nanoseconds. Again, the ratio is 1.7. And what does that prove? That proof is that superflow in solid is very analogous to in superfluid potential flow, irrotational flow.
Okay? I have a very naive theorist question. When you say you have this blocked annulus, do you actually put the barrier in, or you build a new?
No, we put a barrier in there.
You
literally,
put it in rather than building a new thing.
We build a new cell.
You build a new cell rather than just sticking a barrier.
Yeah, that's.
Because I'd be worried about things going around the barrier, sneaking past or something.
Yeah, well, and then to the extent that we know, there's no leakage through it. And then if there's leakage, there would be Josephson effect. That would be even more interesting, but that's a different story.
Josephson effect? You mean because it's like a narrow junction?
Well, if I can put a weak link, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But we've not done Josephson.
So isn't that the next thing you should look for? See that
it's absolutely right. But right now, basically, the parameter space we are facing at, because of workshops like this, talking to theorists and so on and so forth, everyone have a favorite thing that want us to do, but the problem is that every single experiment takes about 2 years to 3 years. And NSF, I don't like to give money to condensed matter physics. Anyway, that's a different story. Here, this is also a cute thing I want to emphasize to you. This is an experiment. We have seen I was telling you, that there is a large effect, this normalized non-classical rotational inertia. If you oscillate it fast, the effect becomes smaller, okay? The nice thing is that in the cell experiment, at different pressure, different sample of solid helium, we have this more or less universal curve. Let me explain to you what we did here, okay? So basically, we go to the lowest temperature, we make a plot at the lowest temperature limit, our apparatus 30 millikelvin, we plot this value and as a function of the drive. Okay? So this is this plot. This is three sets of sample, in other words, solid helium, 26 bar, 108 bar, 136 bar. This is also showing, surprisingly, it survived up to very high pressure. At higher pressure, this absolute superfluid density become a lot smaller, but you can normalize it by dividing it, and you have this form. What is interesting about it is that, how do you get a number? By the way, I forgot to say, we say that we have to oscillate 7 angstrom because that if you oscillate faster than that, the effect becomes very small. As it turned out, if this is a liquid film, if it's a superfluid film, you don't have that problem. You can oscillate it very, very hard. You have no problem at all. And in solid, it seems to have a strong effect at approximately 10 microns per second. 10 microns per second is the maximum speed. Where can we get the scale come from? One way is, of course, that there's such a thing called quantization of circulation of Onsager and Feynman. That is to say, again, you go back to the discussion that we say you have a wave function going around the loop. Therefore, you go around the loop once, the phase increased by 2 pi, 4 pi, 6 pi, and so on and so forth. And the superfluid velocity can be interpreted to be the gradient of the phase, or is the gradient of the phase. If you go do this line integral along the loop, and according to Onsager and Feynman, you basically have quantization of flow, this h, the famous h, everyone in this room love, divided by the mass, and n is the integer. For example, n, 1, corresponds to 2 pi, 4 pi when n goes up. So the one way you can get a number like 10 micron per second is that if you do this, the geometry we have, when this corresponds to 3.16 micron per second, correspond to n equal to 1. Now for liquid film, particularly liquid film or liquid, then this n can be very large, 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th, or that number. And super solid, this number seems to be unity. Well, it could be either the fact that we something like the magic n equal to 3 is a magic number, or this the effective mass is not the bare mass of helium 4, or something like that. Another thing we're grappling with in this conference is that the some of the data, you know, this is not as particular for the helium in vehicle glass. That is, you put helium 3 in it. Now, by the way, we have done the other control experiment, like we fill it all with helium 3. The effect is not there, all right, because helium 3 is a fermion. At least it's not there down to 25 millikelvin. If you go down to microkelvin, who knows, maybe solid helium 3 also have pairing or something like that. Another thing we don't understand is that what happens if you have small amount of helium 3 impurity in it. And it is very counterintuitive. Helium 3 being fermion, you expect that it should spoil the superfluid, the boson exchange or something like that. When you put very small amount of helium 3, 85 ppm, we have data in other things in lower, that the transition temperature instead of like 200 millikelvin actually shifts up practically 1 Kelvin. There's something we don't quite, well, one possible way to understand that is that helium-3 is intimately related to vacancy. And then there is theoretical consensus, then after all this year, that vacancy or disorder are very important to have this. I was telling you that the ultrasound experiment shows something rather interesting, 0.2 degrees. The interpretation is a little bit open to discussion in terms of the hydrodynamics of the system. And of course, you may ask, and another interesting question is that, well, are there other experimental signature of that? Well, I'm also pleased to say that there are three other groups, but they're all using torsional oscillator technique. The one in Tokyo, one in Kyo University, both in Japan, and also my mentor, John Repke, also have confirmed the observation of non-classical rotation inertia. And the result of John Repke is quite interesting. There's a bit too much detail I want to say now. Obviously, when you something like that, you may want to say, well, are there thermodynamic signature and heat capacity signature? As it turns out, doing heat capacity experiment, a simple thing, right? Like a junior year college. It's not easy to do in solid helium because solid helium, heat capacity is very small. And in order to do the high pressure, you have to put it in a container somewhere. The container contribute a lot more to heat capacity, therefore you have to subtract it out. So that was sort of difficult. And this is a try my student, Tony Clark. And here we just cannot conclude anything below 90 millikelvin. At least in this range, we don't see anything near 200 millikelvin. That, of course, give us pause to thinking about what kind of phase transition is it? How come there is no heat capacity signature? However, in this set of data already, the previous measurement of heat capacity always stops about 150 millikelvin or 200 millikelvin for the reason I was telling you. And here it is also showing there's some deviation from T cube. This is a T cube line because solid helium is a model system for Debye solid. That the T cube dependence. There's some deviation from it. Here, I'd like to tell you that this is really, I just got the data last night. And here we extend the measurement heat capacity of solid helium to lower temperature. Okay, but this is very, very unusual, I want to emphasize. The fact that here this is T cube, so we are saying that you, in fact, have the heat capacity has a linear T component to it. This is the physics, the helium physics community really never expected, I think. And here, this is a typical plot you can try to show what are the things you have here. C over T divided at versus T squared. Because, okay, I do want to use the blackboard a little bit. If you have, assuming this is the case, then again, if you like, if you plot it like that, therefore, if you plot this, C over T versus T squared, the slope give you B, the intercept give you A. There is definitely a linear T term. But it's also interesting that where does it start to come in? It starts to come in, the linear T term starts to become important when we start to see the superfluid response. It is possible they are related. So I think this is something that we'll have to spend some time discussing what's the origin of that. Now let me also show you something more striking. That is, well, solid helium has super solid. It seems to have a super solid phase according to the measurement we have done. Therefore, you can ask the question, is that unique? Well, one way to look at it is that why don't we look at another bosonic molecular solid? Well, that would be hydrogen. That is the next one to be the most quantum mechanical. Right? The way you can do that in physical chemistry or chemical physics, the way to determine which molecular system are most quantum mechanical are very simple. You take a ratio, this is a so-called the Bohr parameter, it's a ratio of the quantum mechanical kinetic energy divided by the attractive potential. This is a so-called the Bohr parameter. This is the next one. So here, again, it's the same technique. All right. Here, instead of plotting change, I just plot the period change as a function of temperature. This is an empty cell. This is a torsional oscillator. This is running at a higher frequency.
Is this power hydrogen?
Yes. Just a second. This is empty. Nothing yet. Nothing yet. The first thing we did is to put HD in it. Why? Well, HD is a fermion. You don't expect to see anything in there. In fact, that is the case. And then you put parahydrogen in there. You see a clear, sharp deviation. And then, also, as a matter of graphology, you blow up this region. You say, this is quite clear. Must be true, right? Something like that. And then, if you're absolutely convinced you're right, then you turn upside down. You say, here, it's non-classical rotational inertia. What is interesting is two things. It's very interesting. Surprisingly, the transition temperature, we want to call that transition temperature, not terribly different from solid helium. However, the magnitude of that, this is 0.05%. The supersolid fraction in helium is 1.5%. So this is many, many times. This 0.05% versus whatever. This is 20, 30 times. And we have done it a number of cases. That is the case that in 83% filling, 68% filling. As it turned out, Peter will know the situation because hydrogen solidify at 14 Kelvin. In order to get something that solidify at 14 Kelvin into a container with geometry like that, you got to struggle. Okay, all right. And then you have ortho-para complication. In other words, the nuclear angular momentum state. So all this, what we can tell you is that we know that this X1 is ortho concentration. At low temperature, the ground state is all para. At room temperature, it's 75% ortho. Therefore, you cool it down, you have to convert. As it converts, it generates heat. Therefore, those are some of the complications. And here, there's two sets of data, even though different filling, they are two different preparation sample, they're completely in agreement. However, if you have a sample of 2% ortho, that the effect seems to be smaller. So those are some of the results that we have. And here, this is one. This is something that we have a lot of. HD impurities. Those are some of the complications we have to work with. Those are the students. Thanks very much. Oh, so let me just say, well, if this is correct, then one possibility, if we see both in helium and hydrogen, therefore, it's almost like doing math. Therefore, by deduction, all bosonic solids are super solid. I mean, no, I mean, yes.
David had any more comments on the theory? Here it is. Second
part.
Oh,
it's supposed to be over 1 hour. Well, if I had a supply of 10 minutes more, it would be right.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to get some. The theorists are all happy with this interpretation.
Well, the interpretation, yeah, no, right. I'm speaking as for myself.
So you guys are very kind, put up in the same office. You're all hoping they won't have a fight,
right? Mutually beneficial. Double occupancy.
I think it's very difficult to explain this data with the simple vacancy mechanism. In fact, everything really points against that.
Which part of the data?
Well,
and what do you mean by the simple vacancy mechanism?
Well, just the idea that you have ground state vacancies that both congest. In fact, there was an experiment we heard about this morning, which essentially measures the indoor vacancies. They would have seen them, it would seem like, and there weren't any. The other neutrons.
Well, I think what David is saying is that if you know, it's extremely unlikely in solid helium we have 1% vacancy. People should have seen it one way or the other.
Neutron scattering or
in the X-ray scattering of a process.
Or some other property.
And then the John Dimash in doing flow experiment, you know, because of the diffusive flow at high temperature due to, you know, vacancy. And also a separate experiment that we have done, that is, which I did not show, that as a function of pressure,
yes,
at low temperature,
you that the phase diagram, right?
Yeah, as a function of pressure, that the superfluid fraction actually first increases pressure and then decreases pressure. The part that increases the pressure is very unlikely, because conventionally you are saying that you increase pressure, you will squeeze the vacancy out. So in other words. So in other words, what we have seen is that as you go up along here, that the supersolid fraction first increase up to 55 and then decrease. You would imagine the more vacancy here.
Yeah, so everyone thought with the Andrea mechanism that you would have a supersolid right down here, this little tiny corner right here. The fact it looks like that is just completely different. The fact that the vacancies would be changing properties.
What is that?
Yeah, that's pressure versus temperature.
Yeah, but there's two curves.
Oh, this is the starts and the other ends. Yeah. So this is, you might think about the starts being a super solid here and then it's fully developed there.
Is it strange that the dividing line between superfluid and solid is almost completely flat and horizontal? Is that a theoretical curve?
It's experimental and theoretical.
It's not completely flat, though.
It's not completely flat,
Let's say, what is the log scale?
Oh, okay.
There is a tiny minimum here near about 0.8 Kelvin, I believe.
Right?
0.8 Kelvin is a tiny minimum. And that is simply because it is superfluid. Okay, because and then you use Cortes Kaplan equation. That's a favorite question that we like to ask students during the candidacy exam. At t equal to 0, it has to be flat completely.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, it gets into the ground state right here in the liquid and also in the solid. Nothing happens. So that's the conventional picture, which super solid doesn't fit into.
The theoretical problem is that the data doesn't look like it was 12.8. But this is a conversation.
Yeah,
Furthermore,
if we're not. And I should say a third point is, this is the system that we've been doing computer simulations for 20 years, and we thought we understood how to do everything, and we don't see it super solid at all. For pure crystal, that is no defects. So, and then we heard here. Then we heard the beginning of the last week. No vacancies. Or now there shouldn't be any vacancies. And
it's even allowed to happen if they want to.
And we heard, Moses didn't say this, but we heard at the beginning of the week, the last week, that there is some history dependence in the results. That is, you can anneal the crystal and change the results for the super solid. So there's something to do with how you prepare the crystal. So I think a much more likely, okay, so I just told you one mechanism.
Vacancies are not the same as defects.
Your vacancies and interstitials would be point defects. So I think what we say would apply to most point defects, unless they get larger and more complicated, that is, have internal structure. I mean, what things are people are talking about are whether a combination of helium-3 and vacancies together is a bound state or something. But I think any point defect is going to have is eventually a problem. Unless you have two helium-3s, right? But then the question is whether there's more complicated defects, and that seems much more likely a candidate to explain it. Namely, dislocations are lines, and so maybe we join in with the string theorists here. Can you have those conversations with lines? See, that could be history dependent. What's that? Yeah, actually, that's right. I mean, people say the words, but it'll take a while for the theorists to figure out how to do the calculation. But yes, most of the, people talk about dislocations all the time, but they're thinking classically.
But what is the story of helium-3? I'm a little confused. It's required that you have helium-3?
Almost. Okay. So we have seen the effect of when we the set of measurement that we've done here. The helium-4 you can get from Texas Aurora, where gas well, is that have 0.3 ppm of helium-3 in it. And that is the solar helium, a lot of us are very happy to call it pure helium-4. Okay. And then here we have done a set of measurements that when we put small amount of helium-3 in it, that's 10 ppm, 10 parts per million, it seemed to... Okay, here. So this is not as striking as the one in the Vico glass, that the superfluid fraction decreases. However, transition temperature goes up. Okay?
A lot.
Okay? Therefore, for the last half a year or so, we have gotten some very pure helium-4. Actually supplied by John Beamish. And then, which has 2 ppb of helium-3 in there. And the first set of measurement we have done, I wasn't going into such detail, and 2 ppb. One thing happened is that we didn't see anything. Now, we can draw a number of conclusions from that. Okay, that's sufficiently pure, that the effect goes away, or that in fact maybe have been pushed to lower temperature, below 30 millikelvin that we cannot reach to. And my student is doing experiment for the so-called high Biot-Rayleigh ratio. But then we go to 47 ppb, which is slightly marked up. Then the transition reappears. However, the supersolid decoupling is smaller than when it's 0.3 ppm. So therefore, you have this funny business.
And a lower temperature.
And it's at lower temperature.
So here, if that seems to mean that if you had 0 Ag3, there'd be no effect at any.
Well, let's don't draw the conclusion yet, because experiments going on at Florida right now, Sweden, because they can cool down to 1 millikelvin, right? So maybe the phenomenon is at lower temperature. That's all.
Yeah, but if you add, but that's a 1 part per billion.
Yeah.
If you went to 0 part per billion.
Well, I think at that point we just have to get the data from 2 ppb, 10 ppb, 47 ppb, and extrapolate what happened.
Right. It's not necessarily this is homogeneous helium-3 is being put in the sample. The helium-3 could affect how the crystal grows very sensitively. So it could be in how the crystal is being grown under different helium-3 concentrations. H2 is not an impurity.
HD is the impurity.
So you have HD impurity.
In H2 always.
And works for the HD.
Yeah, and look at that. This is once the experiment. Oh, here. This set of data is really taken, really empty cell, HD, and we thought we'd clean it up. We cleaned up the experiment and put H2 in it. As it turned out, we don't really know the HD. Therefore, HD concentration is uncertain. It's most likely higher than 200 ppm. And therefore, in that case, you notice that it shifts to lower temperature. Here, in HD, it's in the opposite direction. You put HD in H2, the impurity, you shift the temperature down. So that's make it more confusing.
You mentioned, and we heard this morning, that one of the other typical phenomena in superfluid, namely superleaks, flow through small channels without resistance, doesn't seem to be happening for this stuff.
No.
What does that imply? For the underlying mechanism.
Wait. It depends on the flow experiment, we don't see it. Yeah. But we also have done an experiment in Vico glass. Mm-hmm. That's much smaller, 70 angstrom. We saw that phenomenon first.
Mm-hmm. It's a puzzle in terms of point defects. But if you think if the thing was loads condensing our lines, then maybe the lines get stuck, they don't flow that way. Right. The lines get stuck on the walls and things.
So because the lines are condensing, you also see when you are keeping it under a frame like an unprecedented density feature. You have the same problem because you make the condensation. I mean, because both condensation is interpassing the wall.
Another question here.
Yeah, actually, did you try to correlate this constant A with the amount of helium-3?
No, we have not done that yet. We have only done one set of measurements. It took us 3 years to get this far. Yes?
This is an idea I just got from one of the figures you showed, the annulus that did the helium, the hydrogen experiments. Unlike your annulus, which was really an annulus with a very thin periphery of the cylinder, that if I put in the picture right, it looks like it was mostly the cylinder. Yeah. But the ground, the ground may be megatons. Anyway, it seems like an interesting experiment to do would be, you saw this residual, when you put in the block, you saw this residual non-classical moment of inertia due to this irrotational flow in the block chamber. That effect would obviously be much bigger if you made your angle effect.
Yeah.
Right. And I assume that at Fedder's paper, he actually calculated the dependence there on the geometry. It seems like it'd be a real good test of what you're observing a superflow that we see if the predicted dependence on the geometry.
That is, as I said, it was calculated to be 1.5 nanoseconds. We see 1.5 nanoseconds.
Right, but
based on this geometry.
Right, I'm saying this would be more convincing if you did it for a variety of geometries, and then you did it for those different geometries in your experiment, you produced that difference.
You're absolutely right.
I know you have a lot of
questions. Right. Okay.
Are you going to make your lab available for him to do the experiments?
No, actually, no, because all my cries said, like, oh, he doesn't want to know. No, it's. There are other phenomena like, are they frequency dependent? In other words, John Beamish's experiment did not see DC flow. I mean, one plus
and then, and then our experiment at Tokyo, Kyoto, Cornell, Penn State always ranges between 2,000 and 100 hertz. Well, maybe by the time you go to 0 hertz, the effect is not there, or something like that.
In fact, the experiment is planned in Cornell.
Good.
Can I ask about a couple of things to do with the frequencies? Is the amplitude of the motion? I mean, clearly the DC experiment would have looked for a rather long motion, and you mentioned 7 nanometers earlier.
7 angstroms,
excuse me. So 7 angstroms, you know, that's a couple of lattice constants, and that's the outer edge. Having come from a friction world where people see all sorts of different things sometimes at small amplitude oscillations.
However, even the 7 angstroms, it does see the large coherence over macroscopic fit.
Yes. But it's not like a change. And the problem is, when you've looked at when people have done the different frequencies, you mentioned 100 hertz up to 2 kilohertz.
Right. And so right now the result from Tokyo, from Kyoto, from Cornell are still in the preliminary stage, that they have not done systematic study yet. So whether it's a speed effect or it's an amplitude effect or things like that, only time will tell.
But the theories would say it should be a velocity effect as opposed to an amplitude effect, maybe, or?
Yeah. But the velocity, you know, because you're more likely to say that because we know about critical current. We know about critical velocity in superfluid, critical current in superconductor. That's just more natural to.
But the answer is no, which is easy.
Well, I think it is really.
Well, there's too much scatter in the experimental data. There's too many uncontrolled things in the experiment. I mean, also, if it depends on the sample preparation, you would like to do the frequency dependence in the same sample. And that's not there now.
Thank you.